Besicha. Two. First of all, I'm not going to enumerate them, but I want to dedicate this sicha once again to the guys, the Masaimim of Maseches Erevin. I'm not going to enumerate them, but later on in the sicha, I will address a point that is noged to them specifically. Number two is I want to, as a kind of foreshadowing, I am not dedicating the sicha to anyone who started Maseches Erevin, Maseches Psachim, absolutely not, because to say you're going to do something, talk is cheap. Anyone could say they're going to do something. So in 4 months' time, 4.5 months' time, if we finish up, then tonight will be dedicated to as well to the guys who Bez Hashem finished Maseches Psachim. But I do want to single out one starter, and that is Zevi Popel. Because, not because he started Maseches Psachim, anyone could start, but anytime there is something to be done in the yeshiva, some help, something, a barbecue, or this, or that, or whatever it is, Zevi on the Shana Aleph side, there are others, but I'm singling out Zevi. He's always there, always pitching in, always helping out, always doing something, and it's definitely something that's very, very chashuv. I also want to single out similar vein. Again, there are others. This is not to exclude about guys who help out a lot. There are guys who help out a lot. But Shmuley Shlita. To his left, just a new guy in yeshiva comes in Shana Bet and kind of just like seamlessly just brings this positive energy to every environment he's in. Mendel Katz, Shlita. So we should all go mechayil el chayil in doing big things. David, how were your first couple of days?
Great.
Yeah, you could be honest. You could be honest.
Really great.
Really great. Yeah. Better than your other place. Are you you're comfortable? You're settling in? What?
Everything's great.
Okay, great. So then we'll also dedicate the Sicha to David with that. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about, I want to share a thought about the parasha, but I want to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving. And the truth is it is very, very appropriate. And it happens to come out a lot that Parshas Vayetze and Thanksgiving coincide. And Thanksgiving is a little bit of a halachic, poses some halachic issues. There are definitely discussions in the post. And Rabbi Safra told me this morning that Rabbi Victor Miller had a very, very strong position, exceptionally strong position against Thanksgiving celebrations, with the position that that its sources were some kind of Christian Avodah Zarah kind of sources, and he felt it was 100% Aser Chukas HaGoyim. Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion that it's an innocent day. It's not sourced in Avodah Zarah. It's not Chukas HaAkum, and therefore to celebrate Thanksgiving would be permissible. Rav Soloveitchik legendarily used to give shiur on the Thursday Thanksgiving. But he would give shir early. He would give shir early on Thursday morning so that people can get home for Thanksgiving dinner. And there was one very famous shir that he gave, which apparently lasted about 7 hours, and he lost track of time. And he started at 9 o'clock, and he went like right through until someone said Higiazman Sudas Thanksgiving, and then he stopped abruptly. And so there are different views. We in Mivaseret actually have a little bit of a Thanksgiving Suda, but it's not a Thanksgiving Suda. This year, our Suda that we'll have, Mitzvah Shem Thursday night, will be enhanced, endowed, and rendered with greater significance because there'll be Mitzvah Shem some Siyumim of Sidrei Mishnayis that will be occasions for real celebration. And I want to make some comments about Thanksgiving generally, and that is the way it's celebrated in the United States. At least at the present time, at least what I remember, I'm a little out of it, but it has become very, very, very commercialized. It's much more about the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and sales and shopping and kind of business, the commercialization of the process, the beginning of the so-called Goyish holiday season, which inaugurates with Thanksgiving and gets us to the end of December, beginning of January. And so it's great to have 2 days off from school and from work, and that's Geschmack. And people like to watch football or play football or do those kinds of things. But the core heart of what L'chora it's supposed to be is a day of, hold up, is a day of Thanksgiving. So I want to address that topic a little bit, and I want to do it through a clear, it works out so well with the Parsha Shavua. And there's a very, very famous Gemara, an important Gemara. The Gemara is found in Maseches Brachos Dav Zayinu Beis. And the Gemara writes as follows: Miyom Shebara Hakadosh Baruch Hu Es Olamo. From the time that Hashem created the world, Lo Haya Adam Hodel Hakadosh Baruch Hu. There was no one who gave thanks to Hashem Ad Sheboasa Leah, until Leah came along, the Hodaso, until she came along and gave Hodah to Hashem. Thanked Hashem Sheneemar, as it says in this week's parasha, Hapam now Odeh Es Hashem. So the first time you have, says the Gemara, any kind of thanksgiving that's given in the Chumash, it's Leah when she has her fourth son, and now she gives thanks to Hashem, which is a strange Gemara. Because I would have thought, Adam and Chava, at some point, Hashem created the world for them, with them, and that should have generated some kind of thanks. Sarah and Avram, after years of having a child, not having children, finally get a Yitzchak, that should have generated some kind of thanks. Noach, the whole world is destroyed. And Noach and his family are saved. That should have generated some kind of thanks. It's hard to imagine that they didn't give thanks. That the Gemara tells that Leah is the first person who gave thanks to Hashem. That begs the question, what exactly is going on over here? And I want to get a handle on Leah a little bit. And Leah is a very, very enigmatic person. To understand who Leah is, what she's all about, she's one of the Imahos, we need to go into a little bit, again, a few psukim to read together. These psukim are primarily found at the end of Parak Chavtes in the Chumash. And we're told, we're introduced to Leah and Rachel, the sisters, as basically opposites. And we are told that Yaakov had a great, great love. Ayehav Yaakov is Rachel. He loved Rachel, and it was for good reason. We're told about Rachel in the opening psukim of the Perek. We're told that ulalavan shtei banos pasuk perek of tes pasuk tes zayin shtei banos shtei magdola leav shem tana Rachel ve'enei Leah rakos, and the eyes of Leah literally were soft. Rashi explains she was crying a lot. She was a crier. Ve'Rachel haisa yifas toar, and Rachel was exceptionally beautiful. Yifas toar ve'yifas maret. Yaakov loved Rachel. He wanted to marry her. And Laban says, no, no, this is not what we do in these parts. We don't go ahead and marry off a younger child before the older child. So, or we first have to work. Yaakov, Rachel, Sheva Shonim. He works for her, and the 7 years of work fly by. Ki yamim achadim, like fleeting days in his love. It's like a real classic story. He works for 7 years, but it goes by like nothing as he awaits his beloved. And of course, the switch is made, and it's instead of Rachel, it's Leah who appears. And as a result of that, and Yaakov sees who it is, so Yaakov emerges with a sense of very strong, but Leah is snu'ah. She is hated to Yaakov. She emerges as snu'ah to Yaakov. And that's a very, very strong word. Vayar Hashem. And Hashem sees Kisnua Leah, that she is hated to Yaakov. And as a result, he blesses her with some children. And when we look at Leah and how she names these children, you see her pathos. You see her sorrow. You see that she's, in a certain sense, I'll use these words, it's sad, it's tragic. She's the second fiddle wife. She is, in a certain sense, the afterthought, a pathetic person, a pathetic character in the Chumash, and you see it as she names her children. She has a child, and her first child is Reuven. Why does she call him Reuven? So the Torah tells us, Taylor ben Vatkashim Reuven, ki amra, ki ra'a Hashem be'anyi. Hashem sees my suffering, my impoverishment, Ki atam, maybe now after I've given Yaakov a child, ye'evani ishi. Maybe now he will love me. Doesn't seem to work out. Vatar od. She has a baby, vatele ben, vatomar. And she says, ki shama Hashem ki snua anochi. Hashem has heard that I am snua. And therefore she calls him Shimon. Vatar od. She has a third child, vatele ben, vatomar ato. Maybe now, hapam yilave ishi. Maybe now my husband will accompany me. Maybe now I'll have some kind of relationship. Al kain kra shma Levi. And that's why he's named Levi. So again, you look at Leah. And it's really, it's sad. She's a tragic person. Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel. He works for her for 7 years and it feels like days. He's anticipating it turns out to be Leah. Leah stands in the shoes of Rachel. Yes, Yaakov will marry Rachel in the end, but Leah is the first wife, but really the second wife. She doesn't have her husband's affections. She understands it. She feels it. She is saddened by it. She's Ene Leah Rakos all along. And it's reflected in how she names her children. And if I asked you right now, in the, we stop the action right now, who would you choose to be? Would you choose to be Rachel or would you choose to be Leah? Leah seems to be not exactly the person we would aspire to be. And then something very dramatic happens. And it's an incredible change, an incredible shift. Then she has her fourth child, whose name is Yehuda. And when she has her fourth child, the Torah tells us that she has a baby, hapam. Now, ode es Hashem. I give thanks to Hashem, and she names the child Yehuda. Rabbi Norman Lamb Zatzal suggests that when it comes to the idea of hodah, of thanks, of thank you, of gratitude, there are two types of gratitude. There are two ways to give thank you. One way is what he describes as a courtesy, a social gesture. He calls it verbal currency. Someone does you a favor, the exchange, the currency for that favor is thank you very much, yashar koach, I appreciate it. And if you don't say those words, you don't express that sense of gratitude, we call you a kafui tov, an ingrate. And sometimes you pay for something that someone does with your money, dollars and cents, and sometimes you pay verbally. If it's a favor, if he's not charging, you pay. It's a sentiment of gratitude and thank you. And this, Rabbi Lamb describes as a low level of gratitude, a low level of thanks, important, necessary, absolutely required. And if you don't do so, you're not being nice. But it is a low level of appreciation. It's a low level of thanksgiving. The higher kind, he says, is not compensatory. He says it's a state of mind. It's not just, oh, you did something for me, thank you very much. It's a stance and approach to life. It is a vision of gratefulness that I live my life with. I am consecrating my life with a sense of gratitude. I look not at what I'm missing, but I look at what I have. I look at my glass, not half empty, but half full. I recognize the things that I have, and I am not just verbally giving the person who's doing me a favor a tip by saying thank you, but my approach to life is one of thankfulness. And says Rav Lam, and this is what Chazal are telling us. Yes, Avram and Sarah and Noach and Adam and Chava, for sure, they said thank you when Hashem bestowed upon them tremendous chesed. But Leah's hodah is something much more profound. It's a whole shift in psyche and in mentality to the point that she says, yes, maybe I drew a bad lot. Perhaps I wasn't as good looking as my sister. Perhaps I wasn't as desirous of my husband, to my husband, as my sister was. Perhaps I was and am the second wife. But at the end of the day, I am married to Yaakov Avinu. At the end of the day, Hashem has blessed me with Reuven, with Shimon, with Levi, and now a fourth child. Hapam, as a result of all of this that has transpired, my stance and my approach is totally different. Hapam Odes Hashem, yes. Despite everything, what I have is pretty, pretty good. And that's a shift in life, a dramatic shift. And from that point on, we see something incredible in Leah. What you will see in Leah is everything changes in her favor. And if you think about it, how many Shvatim did Leah bring to the world? She brought six Shvatim herself. Six Shvatim herself. Half of the Shvatim come from Leah. She, the Pilegish, but I'm talking Leah herself. Leah had six Shvatim. Where, if you look at Rachel, Rachel, after a time, is also frustrated. She can't have children. Vatikane Rachel ba'achosa. And now Rachel is jealous of Leah. And she says to Yaakov, Habali Panim, I want children too. Vim ayin mesa anochi. So Leah starts to see what she has. Her sister is barren. She has children. Finally, when Rachel does have a child, and Yosef is born to Rachel, Perek Lamed Pasach of Dalva Tikrat Shmo Yosef. She has Yosef. And what does she say when she names Yosef? Yosef Hashem Li Ben Acher. Hashem should give me another son. And she'll be blessed with another son. But it's all of a sudden like the tables have turned. And think about how Leah's life transpires. She has six Shvatim. Where is Rachel buried? Rachel. Where's Rachel buried? She's buried in Kever Rachel, yes. Outside, literally outside of the boundaries, then boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. While she's having her second son, Binyamin, in the midst of that labor, she perishes, and she's not buried next to Yaakov. Where's Leah buried? Leah's going to be buried in Maras Machpelah, and for eternity, she lays, if you will, next to Yaakov Avinu. Who produces Malchus in Klal Yisrael? Which mother produces Malchus in Klal Yisrael? So the answer is they both do. Shaul comes from which Shevet? Binyamin. Shaul came from Binyamin. So Shaul comes from Rachel. And Shaul had every opportunity to be Melech Yisrael. He had all the features and qualities. But his Malchus fizzles out. And who has the enduring Malchus of Yisrael? That's David, who comes from Yehuda, who comes from Leah. Where does Mashiach come from? Not so fast. There are two Mashiachs. There's Mashiach ben Yosef. Mashiach ben Yosef comes from Rachel. Mashiach ben Yosef gets it started, brings about the beginning. But the enduring Mashiach, the Mashiach that is the ultimate Mashiach, is Mashiach ben David, comes from Yehuda, comes from Leah. The institution of Kahuna and Leviah, Levi and Cohen, where does that come from? Comes from Leah. All of the enduring institutions of Klal Yisrael, Malchus, Six Shvatim, Maras HaMachpelah, Kahuna and Leviah, it's all Leah. And how does Leah start her career off? We're told, Eine Leah Rakos. She's a crier. She's destined to Esav. She's crying. She's teary-eyed. And her eyes are soft because of that. But which of the Imahos is the ultimate crier of the Jewish people? That's Rachel Mevake Avonel. She's the one who cries for potential not realized. For people that do not achieve potential, dying in Gullus, being in Gullus. Rachel is the ultimate crier of the Jewish people. So strikingly, and it all changes, it all shifts once Leah makes her shift. Once Leah becomes that person who is Hapam Ode Es Hashem, she's focused not on what she's missing, but on what she has. All of a sudden, everything for her falls into place. And I think this is a fundamental Musar Haskel, because especially for young people, as you get older, you kind of lose this sense. But when you're young, everyone feels, it's a normal thing to feel, it's a natural thing. I have everything coming to me. And when I'm missing any little thing, if not something is a little bit imperfect, So I notice not what I have. I notice what I am missing. And when the Gemara tells us that Leah was the first person to give Hodat Hashem, again, Rabbi Lam explains that what it means is this posture in life, to have a sense of a stance of gratitude, a stance of what I have. Focusing, and again, when you look at Black Friday and all the advertising that goes on in the world, what the advertising is doing and their mission and their goal is to focus, enable you to focus on what you don't have and asks you to think about what you're missing and the latest Apple device and the latest plasma television, the latest gadget, whatever it might be. You don't have it, you need it. If you're missing it, your life is incomplete. What you are missing in life, that's what advertising does. But happiness is not focusing on what you're missing. Happiness, and if you want happiness in your life, it's focusing on what you have. As Chazal tell us, Ezehu Ashir Hasameh Pechalkon. It's so true. It is so true that when you're wealthy, you appreciate what you have. When you appreciate what you have, then you are wealthy. Yadus asks us to stop, focus, not on what we're missing, but on what we have. Rabbi Sachs points out very beautifully that all week long, our focus is on the price of things. How much things cost, what their price is. Shabbos, a person's asked to stop and start focusing not on the price of things, but on the value of things. And all too often, we're not focused on the value of things, what's truly, truly important. Rabbi Sachs further says, in a beautiful concept, the first words that we say every single morning, and it's critically important how we say those words. We don't say, ani modeh, focusing on the I. The first words out of our mouths are modeh ani, modeh. Before we think, we thank. We thank before we think. And that's a fundamental idea. And the whole name of Yehudi, what a Yehudi is, comes from Yehuda, comes from this idea of modeh, of a sense of appreciation. So I told you last week a little bit of a story about my law firm. So I wanted to sequel for a second, just one little tidbit that I think is no gay to this message. And I mentioned last week that I used to go back for the summers. And would work in the summers, that enabled me to make some money and then come back and make some part and be able to learn. So invariably, my first week back in New York was either the first of June, usually the second week of June. And invariably, my law firm, the second week of June, they had something known as the summer outing. First Monday, second week of June, Monday, the second week of June, was a summer outing. Invariably, I'd fly out Motzei Shabbos, land on Sunday. My first day of work was that Monday. And I would ask them, should I come on the summer outing or not? It's a little weird to come just for the... And they said, yeah, why not come for the summer outing? Now, what is the summer outing? So every summer, that Monday, only lawyers allowed, no spouses, no support staff, no one, just the attorneys. And they take you to a place called the Sunningdale Country Club. Sunningdale Country Club is a Spitz country club. And basically, everyone comes there and spends a day basically enjoying themselves with things like golf and tennis and swimming and opulent food and a good time is had by all. Now, I remember vividly my first two summers back and I went for the summer out. I ended up going with my father-in-law's vehicle of some kind of Hamish vehicle. And the parking lot in the Sunningdale Country Club was absolutely full of Mercedes, Lexi, Jaguars, and the like. That was what the parking lot was full of. And I was just coming from Israel, literally off the boat, off the plane, straight to this place. And here I was hanging out with the Israeli coal guys. Now I don't know if you've ever seen what the Meretz apartments look like. Some of the Rabbanim here live in those apartments. I will just generously say that they are, most of you probably have kitchens in your house as big as their entire apartment. They're absolutely minuscule, about 40, 45 meters, which is very, very little, two bedrooms. And basically, the bedrooms are such that, master bedroom, it'd be funny calling it master bedroom, but basically there's room for two beds, and that's it. And the children's room is a smaller room. And then the so-called, what do you call it? The living room doubles as a living room, dining room, multi-purpose room, and that's where everything is. And then there's a tiny little kitchen which has a cabinet and a countertop, and that's basically the whole thing. It's tiny. And I think I didn't live there. My wife would not live there, no way. But I came from people that were living in this environment, and it was amazing. But I saw in the Kohl guys that I was learning with and living with, they were living with nothing. They had no money, living like with nothing. And they were the happiest people in the world. They were living besimcha, happy, and just like, what could be better, sitting and learning in Eretz Yisrael? Then I got to this first day, remember vividly, I got to the Sunningdale Country Club. And I see this affluence. It's really a wealthy place, and the people there are quite wealthy, driving fancy cars, fancy everything. And I'm listening, and I'm like trying to make some small, I'm not a small talker, but I'm rejoining some of my colleagues. And I hear a partner who's probably making about $2 million a year, kvetching to his friend how he's struggling to make the mortgage. He has a ridiculously high mortgage, and he's struggling, he's kvetching, he doesn't have enough. He doesn't have enough. And like this is the most incredible Musar Haska for me. Because here I'm coming from people that are living with nothing, with zero, and they're the happiest people in the world. And I'm going to people who have everything when it comes to Gashmias, and they're totally miserable, totally thinking about what they're missing, what they're lacking, and they're living in the seat of luxury. And it's this very core idea, is that if you're in a stance of Ezehu Osher, Hasamer Pechelko, even if you have next to nothing, you can be happy, you can be joyful, because you're focused on what you have. And it could be a life of gratitude, because your cup is indeed half full, and it's probably much more than half full. And then you can be living a life where your cup is filled to the tippy-tippy top, but there's perhaps a half an inch that might not be full. And there's something not perfect, and all of a sudden everything gets undermined. And that, to me, was a striking, striking contrast. That's one aspect of the Leah story, is her shift from a posture of tragedy to a posture of gratitude where everything starts to fall into place. But there's one other aspect I want to focus on, and that is a word that that I think is worthy of talking about while we're in yeshiva. And it's a word that was made popular by a psychologist, a woman named Angela Duckworth, who speaks a lot and has written a lot about a four-letter word called grit. And the concept of grit is a... Can we open windows, please? It's a little stickle warm in here. The concept of grit. She writes. She used to be... She worked as a teacher for some time, and then she went to graduate school, got a PhD, and went into psychology. And she, her and her team researched the West Point Military Academy, and they tried to predict which cadets would make it through their military training and which ones would drop out. They went then to a national spelling bee and tried to predict which children would go furthest in the national spelling bee. They studied rookie teachers working in really tough neighborhoods, tried to figure out which ones would survive till the end of the years and which one would not. And what they came out with, and the so they came out with, was that the single most important criteria and characteristic for long-term success, the predictor of success, was not intelligence, was not high IQ, was not physical health, was not good looks. It was this thing called grit. What is grit? What's the best way to translate? Her definition is passion and perseverance for very long-term goals. Grit is having stamina. Grit is sticking with your future, day in, day out. Not just for the week, not just for the month, but for years. and working hard to make that a reality, that future reality. Grit is living life like it's a marathon and not a sprint. And she's got a website, which I looked at today, and she has like a grit gauge. Like, how do you determine if you have this thing called grit? And I wrote down 6 characteristics of what grit means. Number one, I enjoy projects that take years to complete. Number two, I'm working towards a very long-term goal. Number three, setbacks don't discourage me for long. Number four, I'm a hard worker. Number five, I finish what I start. And number six, I never stop working to improve. Those are the litmus tests that she writes for grit, and grit is the single most important ingredient for long-term success. We will all have setbacks in our lives, in our jobs, in our relationships, in our years in yeshiva. I promise you, you will have setbacks. You'll have days where you're not in the mood. You'll have days which Rav Volbe calls yemei sina. You'll have days you wish you were anywhere else, but in your room, in these dorms, in the Beis Medrash, in the tshul, wherever it might be. And some people will have those days and will quit, will check out, will say, I can't. This is not for me. I'm not up to it. And others will, as she writes, hard work, never stop working to improve, and despite challenges and despite failures, will persevere and will push, will have the passion and perseverance for very long-term goals. And it's not always easy. And anyone who sells you on easy is selling you something that's not true and not real life. Leah was a person, I would add, in addition to her idea of Hapam Ode Es Hashem, she had the midah of grit. Hard thing to say, weird things to say about one of the imahos, but I'm saying it. Despite tremendous challenges on a personal level, she continued to push forward. She continued to grow. She continued to search for the answers. And at some point she found them. And it wasn't short term. She could have given up when Rachel was taken. She could have given up with Reuven, with Shimon, with Levi. No. She perseveres. She looks big picture. And at the end of the day, as we mentioned, she achieves everything. You know, there's a phenomenon these days, which I'm not a fan of. I wonder how they work in yeshiva. But you go to college and they have, at the end of the semester, websites. Rate my professor. I don't know about Hilchos Lashon Hara and all these other things. I'm not going there right now. But rate my professor phenomena. And studies have shown clearly that the professors that get the highest ratings are the ones that give the best grades and tend to have the easier classes. Those are the ones that get the highest ratings. Lower ratings are teachers that give tougher tests and are more demanding of their students. Happens to be, though, that the teachers that give tougher tests and that are more demanding of their students happen to have those students that produce much more significant and greater learning gains, both short and long term in life. I remember vividly I had a 6th grade and 7th grade math teacher. Her name was Mrs. Glick, and she instilled fear in every single one of her Tom and Tommy dots. We sat there, we walked into the classroom with a sense of tension. You walked in and you were tense because if you spoke out of turn, she clobbered you. It was an atmosphere in the classroom that was real deal. She gave pop quizzes 2-3 times a week whenever bala, she gave a pop quiz. So you have to be always prepared, always ready. and an amazing thing happened. We were all scared in the beginning. But by the end of sixth grade, by the end of seventh grade, every single one of her students recognized and understood she was the best teacher that we all had. And we missed that when we didn't have her in eighth grade. And I remember that vividly. We were scared. We didn't act at all out of turn. Perfectly behaved. With a sense of tension, and like every time those pop quizzes came, oh, another one. But at the end of the day, she produced students that whatever sixth and seventh grade math is all about, knew their sixth and seventh grade math. Lahavdil, Elif Havdalos. Back to the law firm. I like to say this over once a year. But there was a partner in my law firm. Remember his name? Gordon Henderson. He was the head of the tax department. Gordon Henderson was what you call a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, or a WASP. Classic. He was the head of the department, and he was absolutely brilliant. Harvard undergrad, Harvard Law School, top, you know, when they put out the top 50 lawyers in New York, he was always on the list. Really, really smart and really, really scary. Why was he scary? Because he was exceptionally demanding of anyone who worked for him. And back in those days, we used to have no cell phones. We used to have these phones on our desk. And there was a big technology at the time was when his secretary would call, your phone would have a little screen on it. And it would say Gordon Henderson's office or secretary. So you kind of like to screen the call, but when you got that call from his secretary that he wanted to see you, again, the tension level rose dramatically. The blood pressure rose dramatically. I didn't do much work for Gordon Henderson, Baruch Hashem. But I did a little bit of work, and I'll never forget it. So I got that call. And secretary says, Mr. Henderson wants to see you. And I'm like, uh-oh, I'm getting tense. I didn't do anything wrong yet, but I knew he had some work for me, and working for him was tension-filled. It was a Monday. He calls me into his office. And he says, are you busy? Now, there's no such thing as, there's no, like, you can't answer that, yes, I'm busy. Like, there's no right answer. You're not busy. You're busy. But you're never too busy to work, take on the task that he has. It's okay. He gives me an assignment. He says, there's a case out there, and I need you to find it. It deals with X, Y, and Z, and I need you to find the case, and I need you to write me a memorandum of law about the case and things that are spawned from that case. I write everything down. Mr. Henderson, when do you need it by? I need it by Wednesday noon, absolutely latest. I had 2 days to do this assignment. I drop everything else, and I'm working on this assignment, doing library research, computer research, everything to find the case. I get the assignment on Monday, all day I'm working. I can't find the case. I'm getting a little nervous. Tuesday, I go to a senior associate that worked very, very heavily with Mr. Henderson. Very close to him, a firm guy. And probably sometime Tuesday, I said, Gordon asked me to look up, find his case, and write up a memo about it, and I can't find the case. I'm not finding the fact pattern that he talked about and his legal principle he's talking. I can't find the case. So Mitch says to me, if Gordon says there's a case, you better find the case. And I'm really freaking out. Grown men have been known to cry very, very forlorn tears after walking out of Gordon's office. I was very uncomfortable. I basically spent the night looking for this case, and came Wednesday, I'm really freaking out because I couldn't find the case. As far as I could tell, the case did not exist. I go back to Mitch. Mitch, I can't find the case. There's no such case. Can't find it. And he tells me, well, okay, you got to go in and tell him you can't find the case. And I was really, really nervous. But I walk into Gordon Henderson and I tell him, I don't think there's a case. And thankfully, Gordon says, Yeah, I wasn't sure that, yeah, there probably is no case. And I breathed a very, very deep sigh of relief. That was this. I want to tell you about the message. There's a message here. You didn't want to get that phone call. But Gordon Henderson produced great lawyers because you worked really, really hard for him. He was demanding. And when you did find something, and he asked you to research something, you had to, he said, research this, you research that, you find the answer. Then he'd say, yeah, but what about X, Y, and Z? He demanded of you to think ahead like a chess master. What about this and this and this? And if you didn't have those answers for him, he would berate you, destroy you, crush you until you started to cry. So you came up with the answers. You thought about it. You thought ahead, five steps ahead. And he made young lawyers into great lawyers if you persevered, if you didn't quit, if you pushed forward. And this is the midah of what I will call grit. Albert Einstein, they say he's pretty smart. At least he was. I quote, "It's not that I am so smart. It's just that I stay with problems longer than others." And that's something to think about, is perseverance, long-term goals, not riding these up and down waves which are part of life, but persevering, pushing through. That, I think, is the midah of Leah. Rav Soloveitchik, by the way, was equally demanding, lahavdil, of his talmidim. And if you were not prepared for shir, he made you feel uncomfortable. If you didn't know all the rishonim on the sugya before you walked into shir, he let you have it. His classroom was a place where it was tense. You didn't just kick back and relax and just like, Rebbe, entertain me with your brilliance and your svaras. He demanded of his talmidim. He demanded excellence of his talmidim. Gordon demanded excellence of the people working for him. Mrs. Glick demanded excellence of her 6th and 7th grade students. You know, we live in a world today where the way young people are educated, like everyone's got to be given self-esteem, and we got to build people up, and we got to coddle people and make them feel good about themselves. And it's all, to be perfectly honest, a bunch of mush. You will turn into mush if that's like what it's all about. And if like, and it's not about you, it's about everything. Again, I gotta turn off these recordings. When things go wrong in life. Sometimes you get a bad lunch. Happens. Sometimes your Rebbe gives a lousy shear. It happens. Sometimes you're not in the... All these things happen. And the second we are over-coddling, we're babying you. If you are being babied and you're used to being babied, you'll be a baby. You'll be a baby. That's what babies stay babies. When that's part of real life. That's part of stepping up. It's part of being great. It's part of overcoming challenges. And that's just, you know, if you want to be successful in any endeavor, it's not a none of you. It's not a musher shmooze like this. I'm just now rambling, but I want the ramble has a message, and the message is we are now entering into. You know, as we move forward, post-teal now. Now we're in the, you know, the depths of Chorazma before Hanukkah. And believe it or not, it's been, you know, for me at least, the past month in yeshiva has been pretty good. We're moving. And I'm just telling you now that if you really want to be moving and you really want to now take it to the next step and the next step, so that's where the midah of grit comes in. And yes, now I'll come back and circle back to the guys who finished Eruv. Because, yes, that's exactly what the midah of grit is all about. Eruvin And I'm not making, I'm not plugging Daf Yomi. Everyone should learn, stay in their sphere and do what they're doing, but do it great. Do it for keeps. Do it so it lasts. Do it so it sticks. Do it so it really means something. And it's part of your core and your essence. But to persevere and look at a goal, 105 blot of a tough masech through the summertime, when there's no structure, through Fridays, through Shabbos, through Yom Kippur, through Chagim, through everything, and to say day in and day out, when I'm not always in the mood, where I'm not always feeling it, but looking at the prize at the end, and looking at the long term, and looking at long term goals, and understand the only way you hit long term goals is by schwitzing the day to day. That's the Mida of grit. That's the Mida of schwitz. And that's the ingredient, in the words of Miss Duckworth, that's the ingredient that is the most significant ingredient for success in any area of life, certainly in yeshiva, certainly in learning, certainly in spiritual growth, but in other areas as well. And the more you demand of your rabbein, if you're looking for your rabbein to spoon feed you, you'll continue to be a baby. If you're looking for your rabbein to challenge you, to push you, to test you, and I say test you, test you, to give you tests, because tests will expand you. Tests will make you greater. Tests will make you bigger. Tests will make you, help you overcome challenges. All of that is what's going to make you your best. So I give you the bracha of Leah Imenu. Is number one is to appreciate what Thanksgiving really is. And it's a stance, an approach to life. It's not about a day at the end of Thursday to watch, at the end of November to watch football. It's an approach to life, approach of gratitude, a stance of gratefulness. And Leah Imenu, who has to overcome so much, but perseveres after all of her struggles, and ultimately the enduring institution of Klal Yisrael, and her legacy in Maras Machpelah, Malchus Yisrael, Kuhuna Levia, and Mashiach ben David, all comes because of the grit and that sense of gratefulness that she has. I want to call on Mr. Sammy Haber Schlitter.